It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who's out to minimalize her life with a 33-item closet.
But first, 11 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, the country is on fire as Sunni insurgents sweep into major cities, the death toll mounts, and citizens try to flee the violence.
How should the United States respond to the crisis? Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry acknowledged that airstrikes on Iraqi targets are under consideration. No answer will probably be an easy one as the administration faces criticism at home and abroad, and the baggage of the 2003 Iraq invasion continues to stir up emotions.
To walk us through the options on the table is Mike McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent at Huffington Post. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, today, British Prime Minister David Cameron has called the ISIS insurgency the most serious threat to Britain's security that there is today. How serious a threat to the U.S. is ISIS politically and also in terms of national security?
Well, I think politically, it's an incredibly difficult issue. And you got a great illustration of that today at the microphones when the Senate leaders had their press conferences. Neither Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, nor Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, had a course of action that they were willing to talk about or recommend. I asked Mitch McConnell directly what he thought the United States should do, and he said, well, I want to hear what the president has to say, because the leaders are going to go over to the White House, I believe, tomorrow and get some sort of briefing. And, you know, the only thing Harry Reid said was, well, we're not going to go back in there. We're not going to go put people and forces back in there. We made that mistake once already. So you get the sense from both sides that there is not an appetite to go back in, but you don't get the sense of what the solution is. And that has a lot to do with the politics here in the United States, I think.
Well, President Obama has ruled out troops on the ground in large numbers. Right now, there are troops on the ground. They seem to be largely there to protect the embassy in Baghdad. And with that off to the side, that seems to leave airstrikes as the option for now. What would the goal be with U.S. airstrikes?
Well, the goal with airstrikes would be to somehow, you know, degrade these forces, slow them down, stop them from taking over more land and more territory. I mean, recently they've taken over, I forget how much of the sort of banking system up there in the north, but you know, something like $400 million seized from the banks up there in Mosul. You know, I mean, that can all be funneled back in to, you know, fuel their operations. So, you know, I guess the idea would be use airstrikes, slow that down, don't let them build up their forces to be a more significant threat sitting there, sort of on the border, the Turkey near Iraq and Iran, where it's obviously pretty volatile to begin with.
And one of the problems with airstrikes, though, seems to be that the insurgents, the fighters are mingled with civilians. So how does that get handled?
Well, that has been handled very poorly so far. I mean, in the places where we've used drones, for instance, in Yemen, in Pakistan, there's all kinds of collateral damage. And if you listen to a lot of the lawmakers who are mostly Democrats, but some Republicans, they look at that and they see, you know, creating new enemies as much as slowing down old ones. But, you know, again, that's another one where it cuts both ways, where you have people say, well, better to be, you know, costing a few extra of theirs than to have our boots on the ground. So is one of those cases where the politics aren't really that clean, although, I mean, you'll find more Republicans saying do more and more Republican or more Democrats saying be more cautious.
Well, let's get a little bit caught up on what's happening today. ISIS is supposedly engaged about 40 miles north of Baghdad. How would you describe the threat to Baghdad right now?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm a little bit out of touch with that specific level of detail, but from what I've heard, there's a lot of fear. There are people fleeing. There are, you know, just sort of that tremendous level of uncertainty. And a lot of it depends on whether you're a Sunni or a Shiite, too. I mean, you've got a Sunni insurgency. So if you're a Shiite, you're going to be very scared, right?
And in terms of Baghdad itself, if the militants, the insurgents reach Baghdad and Baghdad falls, what's at stake?
Well, what's at stake is, well, obviously control of the capital. For the United States, we have that huge embassy and compound there. They would have to get all of that out of there. I don't know how you would defend that if you were surrounded by an offshoot of al-Qaeda, a former branch of al-Qaeda that even al-Qaeda occasionally distanced itself from these days. It would be extremely difficult, and, you know, what do? You just blow it all up? I really don't know the answer to that. I asked Senator Jay Rockefeller, who used to head the Intelligence Committee and was very involved in the original vote to go into Iraq, and I, you know, what do you do now, Senator? And he was like, well, right now there's nothing good to do, and probably the best thing to do is leave it alone. He thought that it was really much more of an internal issue, and that they'll eventually work it out, and you certainly have to be on your guard, but he thought going back in or getting more involved or firing, you know, airstrikes and things like that may actually make it worse.
And why? What's the feeling on that? Why would that be?
Well, because it's fundamentally a conflict within Iraq, a sectarian conflict within Iraq. And having the United States come in, which is seen as an enemy by many people there, Shiite and Sunni alike, only complicates the issue in terms of sort of explaining how the world is sort of looking at the place, because you've got bombs going off, and as you said before, it'd be a lot of the killing would be indiscriminate. It wouldn't be clean. It couldn't be surgical, even though they use that phrase. So you end up creating more problems on both sides than you would necessarily solve. Now, that being said, he was very aware of the potential of it becoming another sort of Afghanistan where you have a bit of a haven. He didn't seem to think that would necessarily happen, but he was ready to admit that was a possibility.
Now, back here stateside, President Obama has been criticized for having a hand in all this, for not negotiating a stronger U.S. presence when the U.S. officially withdrew. How culpable is the president, do you think?
Well, I think it's hard to lay too much blame on the president. Al-Maliki, the current leader there, has sort of run the word partisan keeps popping into my head, it's up here on Capitol Hill, but it's really much more, he's been sort of dedicated towards the sort of Shiite side of things, and he has not brought the Sunnis into the government. So, you know, if you're Obama and you can't cut a deal with this person who is sort of got his own agenda, you know, how much is that your fault? You know, how much of the blame does one half of the negotiation get? Especially when you were picking up where your predecessor left off. You know, you can probably level some of the blame on him, but I would imagine that you probably want to go back to the folks who started it all before you start blaming the guy who tried to clean it up.
Well, one question on the table right now as the U.S. considers its options is, should the U.S. coordinate efforts with Iran? Iran seems to be willing. How do you expect to see that unfolding?
You know, I actually, I laughed when I first heard that. They were meeting on the nuclear issue, and then they had a little side meeting on Iran, or on Iraq with Iran. And, you know, you probably have to deal with whoever you can to try and prevent the situation from becoming as bad as some people fear it might be. And if that happens to be Iran, well, then you talk to Iran. I mean, it is a little bit ironic that considering all the heated verbiage flung Iran's way, that now we might be in a position to need them to control a situation that's getting out of hand in Iraq and in Syria.
Now, in our last minute here, Mike, in a piece you wrote for the Huffington Post yesterday, you analyzed how the rationales for going into the 2003 Iraq War have changed over the years. Tell us what you found.
Well, you know, if you remember back to 2002 and 2003, it was all about, we need to stop, you know, the next Hitler from arising and using weapons of mass destruction to destroy the United States or harm our allies. Well, you know, as we all know, no WMD were found, and Saddam really didn't seem to pose all that much of a threat. So folks are now, mostly folks who want to blame Obama for the way things are now, are saying that 4,500 Americans died to liberate Iraq. Well, yeah, I mean, in effect, they did, but they didn't go there to do that. They went there to go stop Iraq from being able to harm the United States, even though that was a phantom mission. So it's a little interesting to find folks sort of ignoring what it was all started for and then coming back so they can blame Obama for wasting all that effort.
And we're going to leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
That was Mike McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent at Huffington Post.
Our next guest decided to streamline her life by taking up minimalism. She started with her closet and launched the six-week, 33-item closet project. She went through a wardrobe, pared it down to 33 things to see if her life felt easier to manage and to be less paralyzed by choice.
Allison Sherwood joins us now. She's an interactive lifestyle producer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what made you decide that this 33-day challenge, paring down your wardrobe items to 33 things, was a good idea?
Well, when I first came across a blog post writing about the benefits of having a small wardrobe, at first I was kind of like, no, I don't think I want to do that. No, I don't think I could do it. But as I started to think more about the idea of making life easier by, you know, limiting your choices in the morning and focusing only on clothes that fit you well, clothes that you like, and things that mix and match well together, I started to think, this could be interesting. So I wasn't really sure how it was going to go when I started, but I thought I'll give it a try and blog about the process and invite readers to do it along with me. And just my goal is to make life easier, but also just see how it changes my perspective on things, not just style, but contentment, being happy with what you have already, and materialism. And society kind of puts a lot of pressure on women, especially, to have a vast wardrobe and to wear a different outfit every day and to look perfect. And so this is kind of an experiment in seeing, can I be okay with just a few things that I really like, and will that make life easier?
You've been doing this now. Are you okay with it?
So far, I have been. I really have been enjoying it so far, and it has made life easier. There are the moments when I look in my closet and I only see a few things hanging there, and I kind of think, oh no. But once you realize you only need one outfit to wear today, then it becomes a lot easier. And it's all the things that I included in my wardrobe are things that I wear all the time anyway. I know a lot of us have tons of clothes, but then we wear the same outfits over and over because those are the things we like the best. So this is kind of just removing all the other things that I don't wear anyway and focusing on the things that I do.
So 33 items, what does that include and what is accepted?
It includes clothes, accessories, jewelry, shoes, purse, sunglasses, coats, although thankfully it's summer, so I don't have to worry about that. But yeah, anything that you wear outside the house. I didn't include workout clothes or undergarments or pajamas or just sweatpants that I'd wear lounging around the house, but stuff that I would wear to work and wear outside the home.
And the rest of the clothes went right in the dumpster, right?
No, I just moved everything into our guest room closet. So now that's, you know, exploding with the rest of my clothes. And hopefully this will help me eventually get rid of a lot of stuff. Another thing I wanted to do is just prove to myself that I can live without the things that I don't wear that all that often, because I do have a hard time letting go of things. I'll keep it because I might want to wear it someday, or I think that I'll need to wear it at some point. So by getting it out of sight, hopefully at the end of these 6 weeks, I'll have an easier time of going through and removing things that I don't really need.
You've invited your readers from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to come along on the journey with you. What have people said about their experience?
Yeah, it's been really fun hearing from readers. There are people not only from Milwaukee, but I've heard from readers all over the world, all over the U.S., who are interested in this or who are doing the challenge along with me. And it's cool to hear how we all have our own reasons for wanting to do this. One person I talked to is her husband's in the military, and so she's moving, their family's moving every 3 or 4 years, and so she's really minimizing everything in her house and in her life because they don't want to move it across the country with them. Other people have gained a lot of weight or lost a lot of weight, and so their clothes just don't, a lot of their clothes don't fit them, so they want to focus on just curating a wardrobe that they're comfortable in for their body right now. Or there are people who, you know, on the other hand, don't know what is essential in their wardrobe and want to focus on investing in some pieces that they're going to get a lot of wear out of. And so they're trying to figure out what they should wear for that. Or there's people who are doing it just to save money because they shop too much. And this is a way to say, I'm going to stop shopping for this amount of time. I'm going to focus on using what I have and see if I can get by that way. I've also heard from a few people who are hitting retirement and they're at a transitional stage in their life where they're kind of switching their wardrobe from a professional attire to more leisure attire. And so this is helping them kind of figure out what that wardrobe should look like and getting rid of the stuff that they don't use anymore. So there's a lot of wide variety of readers who are doing this, and it's really fun.
Have you heard from any men picking up the challenge?
Most of them are women. I have heard from women whose husbands are doing it along with them or who are already doing it. And I think, I don't know, I think a lot of us think it'd be easier for men since...
Probably.
I'll admit. But I don't know. I went through and I counted my husband's clothes in his closet and he didn't have as many as I did before the challenge started, but he still had a lot. I think that men have the same problem as women with getting sentimental attachment to clothes, and it might be something that they don't fit into or will never wear again, but they have an emotional attachment to keeping it, so that makes it difficult to get rid of things.
Well, Rob is a bit of a clothes whore, so this could be something that would fit your bill.
I did just purge some things, and definitely I will admit I did have things in that category of, oh, I used to really like that shirt when I wore it last 3 years ago, and I finally made that purge. So yeah, I could see guys getting into this.
I struggle with that a lot, and I'm, you know, once I go back to my closet and try to pare down all the stuff that I've hidden away, you just have to keep in mind that the memory is in your mind, or you have photos of yourself in that outfit. It's not the actual piece of clothing that holds your memory.
And what have you noticed as your day-to-day life unfolds now that you don't have this, you know, 400-item wardrobe to confront you every morning? What's changed?
It is easier picking out clothes to wear. I can mix and match really easily. I've gotten a little more creative with the clothes that I've chosen, so that's actually kind of fun, putting together combinations that I might not have worn before. Laundry has actually gotten easier. I was really nervous that it was going to be such a pain having to do laundry more often than I normally do. I don't like doing laundry. Who does? So I normally just let it pile up for as long as possible and then have this huge load to do. And that takes a lot of time. But it's actually a lot easier to just do a small load weekly. And I've started just combining whites and darks and, you know, towels and whatever needs to be washed together, and doing a small load saves a lot of time. So, it's been another thing I've learned is that it's okay to wear the same outfit more than once before washing it, as long as it's not, you know, totally dirty. And even in the same week, if you're not going to see the same people that you saw when you wore it the first time, wear it a second time and nobody knows the difference. It's okay.
Allison, if you hadn't noticed, we're in Wisconsin. We have seasons. Do you get to pick out a new 33 when winter rolls around?
Yeah, well, this challenge that I'm doing ends on July 12th, and I'm not really sure yet what I'm going to do after that, if I'm going to continue and pick a different set of 33 items or what. But there are there is a popular challenge out there called Project 333, where people do a similar 33-item wardrobe, and they do it for 3 months and then switch it seasonally. And so they just kind of rotate through different seasonal 33 items, not even changing the whole wardrobe, but swapping in a few things here and there to make it appropriate. And I don't want to commit at this point to doing that, but it does, they're a part of, you know, that sort of is starting to appeal to me now that I've seen the benefits of wearing less clothes.
All right. Well, it's an interesting project. We'll have to see if you inspire anyone here on Central Time to try it. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Allison Sherwood. She's an interactive lifestyle producer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
As more doctors seek a balance between professional and personal life, many choose not to set up their own practice, but instead work for a hospital system. The economics of health reform also play a role, but as Shemaine Mills reports, there are some who refuse to change.
Dr. Paul Wirch practices at the Wildwood Clinic he founded with his wife in Madison in 1978. As he examines a 92-year-old patient, he makes sure to speak loudly and clearly.
Okay, breathe in and out. Good. Your heart sounds good.
Medicine has changed a lot in the 35 years since Dr. Wirch set up practice. When he started, there were no cell phones, no electronic records. Diseases that were once a death sentence now can be cured.
When I started practice, childhood leukemia was almost uniformly fatal. I mean, all the kids died, and now it's almost all the kids are live nice, normal lives after that.
That's the upside. The downside is how medicine has become, in his words, a commodity as private practices get absorbed by hospital systems.
And instead of really providing good patient-oriented care, you're now providing a one unit of healthcare commodity, and it doesn't really make any difference who provides it, and it doesn't really make that much difference how good a job you do. You get paid a unit price for it.
On the other hand, clinics run by hospital systems can bring salaried doctors and specialists together under one roof. Charles Chabanneau says the benefit is more coordinated care. He's senior medical consultant for the Wisconsin Hospital Association.
That has really added to well-coordinated care, better outcomes, safer care. That is clearly a benefit to patients as a whole. But let me emphasize again, I'm not implying that you can't get the same kind of care in the independent practice model.
Kurt Mosley is with the national physician placement firm Merritt Hawkins. He says most doctors want to join a system instead of set up shop on their own.
The doctors aren't necessarily better or worse. We just have to get more efficient. There's more patients in the mix now. Our patients are more unhealthy than ever. You know, we're the most obese population in American history.
75% of doctors in Wisconsin are salaried employees. It has as much to do with the lifestyle doctors want as with the money hospitals can make under this arrangement. Doctors often have more regular hours and don't deal with billing. Hospitals get more patients and get better government reimbursement. Take a common procedure described by national health care payment expert Harold Miller.
So there's two places you can get a colonoscopy. You can go to a gastroenterologist's office and get a colonoscopy, or you can go to a hospital outpatient department to get a colonoscopy. How much does Medicare pay for those things? When they go to the hospital gets paid separately for the colonoscopy. So guess what? It actually costs twice as much to get your colonoscopy in the hospital.
But hospital-run clinics are where most patients are going, and the trend will likely continue, says physician recruiter Mosley.
I think practices are five or less are just not going to make it. They just can't make it financially. So practices of five or less probably don't have a future in healthcare delivery.
Wirch practices with a dozen other doctors at Wildwood's two locations in Madison and Cottage Grove. So far, the independent facility has repeatedly rebuffed offers to sell. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
When it comes to reducing drunk driving in the United States, there seems to be a sense among a lot of people, especially in Wisconsin, that stiffer penalties are needed for those who drink and drive.
There's more we can be doing and a different approach, says our next guest, and tough DUI laws can only go so far if we don't give people reasonable alternatives to drunk driving in the first place. She's looking at things like mass transit and ride-sharing apps as possible parts of the solution.
We're joined now by Summer Mathis, editor of the website City Lab, where she recently wrote the piece called What If the Best Way to End Drunk Driving is to End Driving? Summer, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you write that you'd be one of the least likely people ever to drink and drive, not because you're necessarily a better person than other people, but because you never need to get into a car after you've been drinking. So how does public transportation factor into the struggle with drunk driving in our country?
Yeah, I really wrote this piece because of my own personal experience, and I think a lot of people who, like I did, I grew up in Arizona, I grew up in the West, or if you grew up in the South or Midwest, you grow up in a place where driving is really necessary. But I made this move to Washington, D.C. About 10 years ago, and over the years, it dawned on me that there were zero excuses to drinking and driving when you live in a city like Washington, which is very walkable. There are multiple different public transportation options. We now have bike share and all different ride sharing app services. And there's just no excuse here in Washington, D.C. But when you live in a place like where I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and where I ended up setting much of this story, it's much more difficult to make those choices. And, you know, if you're a grown up and you want to have a couple of cocktails, you really have to think about that all the time. It's sort of a constant worry. I lived in Los Angeles for 5 years, and you know, you always had to moderate what you were drinking and make those choices about, you know, oh, I guess I can't drink tonight because I know I have to drive. And here in Washington, D.C., I don't know anyone who has to make that choice. And I think, you know, a lot of the strategy for drunk driving campaigns to end drunk driving, which are quite admirable, are really focused on, you know, punishing drivers. But there ought to be a way to come at it from the other side and say, if you want to drink, if you're planning to drink, you know, here are some other options. You don't have to drive at all.
You've actually said that you, with yourself, have gotten less tolerant of the notion of ever driving with any sort of alcohol in your blood because of the fact that you never have to do it anymore and you don't think that anyone else should have to do it. Do you think that, you know, as you talked about, Mothers Against Drunk Driving has been one force shaping this debate, but do you think that we've been approaching it from the wrong angle?
Well, I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving has been obviously the most high-profile anti-drunk driving group since it was founded in the early 1980s. And, you know, they've done a lot of good. You know, drunk driving-related deaths have, in fact, been cut in half since they were founded. You know, when they first started, there were 20,000-some-odd drunk driving deaths every year in the United States, and now it's closer to 10,000. And I certainly don't want to diminish what they've achieved. And at this point, they're really focused on sort of data-driven solutions to reducing drunk driving. So they're very focused on things like high-visibility law enforcement efforts, which includes, you know, the sort of stops you see on major holidays. And they're very interested in pushing more and more states to adopt those mandatory ignition interlock devices for all DUI offenders, which are, you know, the kind of in-car breathalyzers where you have to blow into a tube before your car will start. And so that's really where they're focused. You know, I spoke with Jan Withers, the president of MAD, about this for this story, and I don't think MAD is opposed to the idea of public transportation being a good option, but it's just not really their focus. And in fact, you know, in city governments all over and state governments all over the country, there's been a big focus on expanding public transportation options. There's been some controversy as some of these ride-hailing apps like Uber have been rolling out. But none of that conversation is sort of meeting together. No one's making the connection between, well, you know, here are all different ways we can give people options to just avoid drunk driving altogether. But no one's really making that from a policy argument, making that connection.
Well, let's look at Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, we have a few major urban centers. We've got the Fox Cities area, Milwaukee, Madison, where some of those bigger city solutions that you're talking about, mass transit and ride sharing, that kind of thing, are available. We've got a lot of rural state as well. How would this sort of solution work there, where there's also a big problem with driving drunk?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think one of the biggest applications of some of these ride-hailing apps that are being developed are in rural and suburban areas, not just in urban areas. You know, one of the hardest things about one of the reasons so many people just decide to go ahead and risk driving home a little bit buzzed even is there's just no other option. And if you have the option of being able to, you know, call for a car just using a smartphone or sending a text, it opens up a lot more possibilities.
You write that Arizona is actually a great place to start when we're talking about drunk driving policy, and a great place that sort of embodies what you're talking about. What has Arizona done that we could learn from?
Well, Arizona's done a number of things to combat drunk driving. One is that they are one of the states that has mandatory ignition interlock devices for all DUI offenders. So as soon as you're cited and convicted of a DUI, you have to put one of those devices into your car. The other thing that Arizona law enforcement officers are able to do is actually cite anyone who is impaired to any degree, whether or not they're above or below the 0.08 blood alcohol content limit. So they have very tough drunk driving laws. But at the same time, one thing that Arizona has done since in 2008, they invested and launched their first light rail system. And for this piece, I spent quite a bit of time riding that system, which runs from basically past downtown Phoenix through the downtown out to their major airport, Sky Harbor International Airport, and connects to Arizona State University, which is one of the biggest public universities in the country. And, you know, there are absolutely college students using the light rail system from campus to downtown Phoenix to go to things like Diamondbacks games, concerts, and in order to avoid having to ever risk drinking and driving.
We're talking with Summer Mathis right now about her piece on providing alternative transportation to help end drunk driving. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
What do you think of our guest's idea? Would you like to see more ways to get home from the bar, the restaurant, the event, mass transit, ride sharing, you name it? And where you live, is there a way to get home from the bar at night without hopping in the car? What's going on in your area? What would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with City Lab editor Summer Mathis about providing transportation alternatives to reduce, maybe even end, drunk driving. What are things like where you are, urban, rural, or in between? Is there a way for people to get home after drinking without hopping behind the wheel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our phone lines right now and take Tricia from Black River Falls. Hi, Tricia.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I like the idea of exploring this topic. I've always lived in rural parts of Wisconsin, and definitely drinking is part of the culture. I mean, whether it's at the bar or social functions like weddings or graduation parties, there's usually drinking, and, you know, people live sometimes more than just a couple miles. Sometimes, you know, you're 10 to 15 miles away from an event. And in the rural community like this one, whether it's a small town or a very rural county, the public transportation options are really few and far between. And there might be a taxi service, or maybe one or two taxis servicing the whole county. Often really expensive and take a long time, wait quite a while. I've tried using I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard. I'm wondering what the guest could suggest for a rural area where budgets are tight, and I'm curious what she would have to say.
Great. Well, thank you, Tricia. And Tricia talking about the culture of drinking and about how hard it might be to get that taxi ride, let alone, you know, a light rail. There's not going to be that. What do you think, Summer?
Yeah, absolutely. Trish is right. You know, and one of the things I didn't get into in the piece, but is you know, how this might be playing out in exceptionally rural areas. But you know, one of the things I would say is that you know, a lot of these ride-sharing services are obviously finding more applications in urban and maybe closer in suburban areas. But I do suspect that there would be an application in more rural areas. Now, whether or not a county government would have the funding to do something like this, but it does sound to me like what Trish is describing is that, you know, leaving those kinds of services up to private entrepreneurs probably isn't happening there. And if leaders in more rural areas are serious about preventing drunk driving, they really ought to be looking at providing some kind of alternative as a matter of public policy. But and I'll also add, you know, there, I don't know what the laws are in where Tricia lives, but I know that in nearby Virginia, here to Washington, D.C., in some of the rural areas, there are even rules about walking home drunk and appearing drunk in public, and there are often not sidewalks or even, you know, and these are in places where bars are required to have a certain number of parking spaces, but yet there's no sidewalks to provide people to, as a way to even walk home as an alternative. There's a whole host of public policy issues that seem to encourage people to drive to and from bars that I think we ought to be taking a harder look at.
Summer, is there any data on this? Have we studied whether places with more public transportation options also have a correlating decrease in drunk driving?
Yeah, there actually isn't. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to write this story, is there's very little study of this. No one has studied whether places with more choices for public transportation have lower incidence of drunk driving. I suspect that they are. There's never even been a full public opinion poll on, you know, matters like whether or not people have different views about drunk driving depending on what options are available to them, and I've spoken to a number of, you know, transportation planning researchers for this piece, and they all seem to agree that this is an area that really needs a lot more study and just isn't studied very much.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Trisha. Appreciate that. And we're going to move next to Brett in Milwaukee. Hi, Brett.
Hi. I'm calling because my can you hear me?
Uh-huh. Yep, you're on the air.
Oh, sorry. My dad is president of the Grant County Tavern League, and they have a Safe Ride program that you can call for free, and they'll take you home, or you can buy a punch card, and it works out really well in Grant and Iowa counties. Everybody uses it, and there's a lot less people out drinking and driving because of the program, and it's free if you can't pay for it.
So you said that's in southwest Wisconsin. Well, how big a region does that cover, Brett?
As far as what towns it goes to, or...
Right. Does it cover some of the rural areas, or is it...
Yeah, it'll take you anywhere that you need to go in Grant County.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for the thoughts there, Brett. Summer?
Yeah, that sounds great. It sounds like, you know, business owners are getting together to take matters into their own hands, and, you know, those kinds of efforts are certainly worthwhile as well.
You talk in your piece about the role of ride-sharing apps, things like Uber and Lyft. How do they factor in? They're controversial right now, but how do you see them as possibly contributing to a solution to drunk driving that you're talking about?
Well, they certainly are controversial, and for more than one reason. You know, in a lot of major cities where there are existing traditional taxi services, you know, understandably those taxi drivers are not happy that they have a lot more competition now. So in that sense, in cities like Seattle and Dallas, there's been quite a bit of pushback to allowing these startup ride-hailing services to operate within the confines of existing laws. In addition to that, of course, companies like Uber, especially because they have this surge pricing model where when demand increases, the prices go up automatically. And so sometimes customers have really complained that they're sometimes surprised by how expensive it can be, which is, you know, a really expensive service to get home from the bars. Not really what I would ultimately like to see. So that variability, I think, is problematic. But, you know, the bottom line is that a lot of city governments, a lot of state governments are looking for ways to kind of get in the way of this kind of innovation. They're they're concerned about the existing taxi companies. They're concerned about safety and regulation and things like insurance. And instead of working with these companies to looking at them as a possible public good, as providing something that would really help with public safety, which should be a priority for public officials, they're often kind of getting in the way and making things more difficult. And that isn't the case everywhere, but it's certainly happening in a lot of places. So to the extent that there ought to be a way to work with these companies and find more ways that they can provide those kinds of solutions for people looking for alternative ways home, you know, that's got to be part of the conversation.
Right, and these things haven't been marketed as a public health solution so far. Do you think that would change the conversation around them?
Yeah, exactly. I do think it would. And, you know, it's the same with one of the things I mentioned in my piece is even big cities that have pretty good public transportation options like Philadelphia, Boston. You know, Boston only added late night subway service a couple of months ago, and they've had a subway for a very long time. But the trains would stop at, you know, 11 p.m. or midnight instead of staying open as late as the bars stay open. And I think that's maybe still the case in Philadelphia. These expanding existing services to make sure they can accommodate people who are out drinking is another part of this conversation. That really isn't, it's not the kind of part of the pitch. You know, the people talk about expanding public transportation as a way to spur economic development or to reduce congestion or air pollution, but it's not, you know, reducing drunk driving is never a big part of the argument there, and I think it should be.
Now, you've written that Mothers Against Drunk Driving hasn't been terribly focused on this angle of public transportation. You've written this article. You've talked with the president. Do you see that changing?
I don't. Not right now. You know, I had a very nice conversation with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but you know, they're really focused on their what they call the campaign to eliminate drunk driving, which has been their platform since 2004, and I think they'll continue to be focused on that. But you know, I did write this piece with the hope that MAD and other anti-drunk driving organizations, you know, might be provoked into at least starting to talk with some of the groups out there that are promoting things like smart growth and transit-oriented development and expanding public transportation options, because it strikes me that it's, you know, they're working toward things that could all be working in concert.
Summer, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Summer Mathis, the editor of City Lab.